Bé, ara sí, després dels parlaments inaugurals començarem amb les diferents conferències que tenim previstes pel matí, pel dia d'avui al matí. Deixeu-me començar dient que és realment en bona mesura reprenent el que deia fa un moment respecte de la col·laboració entre diferents institucions. Aquesta col·laboració em sembla que va ser especialment rellevant o important en el sentit que podem tenir avui una conferència inaugural per a aquest col·loqui que podríem dir que és en bona mesura excepcional. Tenim per inaugurar, com deia aquest col·loqui, el professor Robert Gerbert, un dels màxims especialistes a nivell mundial sobre els estudis vinculats a les guerres en general, però en particular a la Primera Guerra Mundial i les seves conseqüències. El professor Robert Gerbert és, a més de professor d'Història Contemporània, és el director del Centre for War Studies de Dublin. Ha estat investigador i professor visitant a diferents universitats, Oxford, entre elles. Ha estat també, va estar a la Universitat Humboldt, Alexander von Humboldt a Berlín. Ha estat també a la Universitat Europea de Florència, etc., a l'Institut Universitari de Florència, entre d'altres llocs. És una figura, ho deia fa un moment, de primeríssima magnitud en els estudis vinculats a les guerres, no només perquè és el director del centre que acaba de comentar, sinó perquè més perquè té una sèrie de treballs de gran rellevància. És autor, entre d'altres, obres de Bismarck Myth, publicat per Oxford University Press el 2005. És autor d'una biografia de Reinhard Heydrich traduïda al castellà. És autor també d'una compilació també que s'ha traduït fa relativament poc al castellà, que és aquesta que teniu aquí, que es va traduir com Imperios en guerra. I és autor recentment, i és aquest sobre el tema que ens parlarà tot seguit, d'un llibre que va aparèixer fa uns pocs mesos sobre el període postguerra de la Primera Guerra Mundial, la violència posterior a la Primera Guerra Mundial. El títol d'aquest llibre, The Vanquished, Why the First World War Failed to End, és a dir, per què la Primera Guerra Mundial no s'acaba, per dir-ho d'alguna manera, l'any 1918, és un llibre que a més es traduirà d'aquí molt poc al castellà, el publicarà Galaxia Gutenberg, i per tant aquest és el tema de les seves darreres recerques, i vam pensar que era absolutament fonamental tenir-lo entre nosaltres per poder inaugurar un col·loqui com aquest centrat, com ja sabeu, a les guerres civils. Per tant, it's a pleasure for all of us. Thank you very much, Professor Gerbert, for being here with us, and it's your time. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for this generous and kind introduction. I have to apologize, my Spanish is non-existent, so I'm afraid I have to give this lecture in English. It is a great honor for me to open this gathering of scholars. My topic is not the Spanish Civil War, but another period of civil wars, perhaps the period in European history with the greatest density of civil wars and ethnic strife, namely the period immediately after the official end of the First World War on the 11th of November 1918, which of course in the standard historiography is the date when we assume the First World War ended. In my lecture, I will therefore address a seemingly rhetorical question. Did the First World War really end in November 1918? The answer to that question I will argue, very much depends on geography, whether you are based in Britain or in France, or indeed in Eastern Europe or Southeastern Europe, where the situation is fundamentally different. I will also try to address a second and somewhat related question, namely, what exactly is the place of the years that I'm talking about, 17 from the Russian Revolution to the Treaty of Lausanne, 1917 to 23, in the more general history of violence in the 20th century. If we're looking at these violent events that occur after 1917-18, are we simply looking at aftershocks of the terrible conflict that raged in Europe between 1914 and 1918, or are we looking at a period in which the seeds were sown for the second and even more devastating conflagration of the 20th century between 1939 and 1945. Obviously, during the recent debates about, during the centenary debates about the outbreak of the First World War in 2014 and in subsequent years, the Great War was generally portrayed as the beginning of Europe's ultra-violent mid-century crisis, or, in Charles de Gaulle's famous words, the start of the Second 30 Years' War. In contrast to these interpretations, I would suggest that we should see the First World War, at least in its first phase between 1914 and 1917, as a conventional, of course extremely violent, but ultimately conventional war, which primarily became an unintentional enabler of new forms of violence that then became subsequently dominant in Europe's mid-20th century crisis. To be sure, the kind of ethnic and politicized, highly ideologically charged violence that we encounter between 1917 and 23, and again, particularly on the Eastern Front after 1939-41, had precedents, notably in the Balkans since the Eastern Crisis of the 1870s, and again during the Balkan Wars of 1912 and 1913. Yet one very important ingredient in the complex mix of causes of post-war violence was only added in 1917, namely the Bolshevik Revolution. But let me take a step back and talk to you, you through some of these points in the hope that they might become clearer and that I can convince you of some of my arguments. To do so, I will look a little bit at a more specific example, and for that we need to go back in time, back to Western Anatolia in the defeated Ottoman Empire in late 1922. On the 9th of November 1922, the sacking of the city of Smyrna began. Turkish cavalry entered what was once the most prosperous and cosmopolitan city of the Ottoman Empire, and the Christian population of the city had every reason to be concerned. Smyrna was a city in which Turks, Armenians, and Greeks had lived together fairly peacefully for centuries. But nearly 10 years of war, basically from the beginning of the Balkan Wars, had changed the inter-ethnic relations fundamentally. After the Ottoman Empire had lost nearly all of its European territories in the Balkan Wars of 1912 to 13, it had, as we know, joined Germany as an ally in the First World War, and in 1918 found itself on the losing side yet again. As a consequence of that, it was stripped of all of its Arab domains in what only then became known as the Middle East. And following that, after 1918, it was again confronted with an existential threat, a threat that seemed to lead to the complete disintegration of Turkey. And that threat came in the form of a Greek invasion army, which had landed in Smyrna in 1919 and subsequently expanded into the interior of the country in an attempt to realize the great dream of Greek nationalism, namely the building of an empire in Asia Minor. The conflict that ensued was extraordinarily violent. It saw atrocities on both sides. Casualty figures are still largely unknown, but we can safely estimate that at least 250,000 people died in the Greco-Turkish wars, perhaps more. Plus, of course, after the defeat of the Greek invasion army came what is known generally as the Great Exchange, or from the Greek perspective, the Great Tragedy or Great Disaster, namely the forced population exchange of up to 1.5 million people, Christians who lived in the Ottoman Empire, Muslims who lived in Greece, were forced to move towards the other country, often not even speaking the language of the country to which they came. This was the first massive forced population exchange of the 20th century, and of course a precedent for what is happening then subsequently in the middle of the 20th century. The sacking of Smyrna was accompanied by major atrocities, the killing of Orthodox Greeks and Armenians, of course famously described in the short story On the Quay of Smyrna by a then fairly unknown foreign correspondent for the Toronto Star in Istanbul, Ernest Hemingway. As the grim fate of Smyrna's Christian population illustrates, the Great War was not followed by a period of peace for many Europeans. On the contrary, violent incidents as harrowing as these were no rarity in what Western historians generally, but rather misleadingly, refer to as the interwar period. Starting with Winston Churchill, who described the various post-war conflicts as obscure and inexplicable wars of the pygmies, that's a quotation, Western historiography has really only just begun in recent years to question the idea that the First World War ended neatly on the 11th November 1918, which is really a chronology that only makes sense for Britain and France, actually less for Britain than for France, because of course Ireland becomes independent. There's a brutal civil war, there's a war of independence, and there are significant outbursts of violence across the British Empire, the Amritsar massacre, for example, violence in Cairo and in other places. So it is a chronology that really only makes sense for a very limited number of combatant states, whereas for most, it does not. Significantly, these massive outbursts of violence tended to occur east of the Elbe River and rarely in the west, with, as I already mentioned, the notable exception of Ireland during the War of Independence and the subsequent Irish Civil War. Here too, in Ireland, astute contemporary observers connected domestic events, the Civil War in Ireland and the War of Independence, to what they perceived as a more general European phenomenon, or a more general European malaise of the post-war period. The Nobel laureate and poet W.B. Yeats, for example, devoted the key lines of his arguably most famous poem, The Second Coming of 1920, to the series of civil wars that erupted across Europe in the wake of the Great War. And these lines read, "Things fall apart, the center cannot hold. What rough beast, its hour come at last, slouches towards Bethlehem to be born." This is actually, by the way, as a footnote perhaps, very commonly quoted poem at the moment, with the great political uncertainty that seems to pervade Europe. But that's just a footnote. It's by sheer coincidence that, and I wasn't intending it to use it as a contemporary comment, but it's remarkable that certainly in the English-speaking media, this Yeats poem, The Second Coming, features very, very prominently at the moment. A second notable contemporary during this period that I'm talking about, the Russian political economist and philosopher Pyotr Struve, observed in 1919 that for people living in East Central Europe, the violence of the Great War not only outlasted the armistice of November 1918, but also had changed its nature. The World War, he wrote, ended formally with the conclusion of the armistice. In fact, however, everything that we have experienced from that point onward and continue to experience is a continuation and a transformation of the World War. Proof for similar sentiments in other states of the Great War are not difficult to find. The famous Austrian novelist Josef Orth dealt with the very same issue in his dark, prophetic novel, The Spider's Web, which was published, serialized in 1923, in which the protagonist is a demobilized lieutenant called Theodor Lohse, so a veteran of the First World War, who, after 1918, gradually becomes entangled in ultra-right-wing paramilitary organizations that specializes in assassinations of people of the political left and so on and so forth. And he joins these paramilitary organizations largely as a result of despair over his loss of professional prestige, the perceived national humiliation of Germany caused by military collapse, and the hostility with which his own family greets his return in late 1918, his return from the battlefields. They could not forgive Theodor, Roth writes, for having failed, he who had twice been mentioned in military dispatches, to die a hero's death on the front. A dead son would have been the pride of the family. A demobilized lieutenant, a victim of the revolution, was a burden to his womenfolk. He could have told his sisters that he was not responsible for his own misfortune, that he cursed the revolution and was filled with hatred for the socialists and the Jews, that he bore each day like a yoke across his bowed neck and felt himself trapped as in some sunless prison. So the escape route from this sunless prison that Orth describes in this novel, which is actually a remarkably perceptive portrayal, contemporary portrayal of the emerging Nazi movement, is of course to join these ultra-right-wing secret organizations that mushroomed not only in post-war Germany, but actually in all of the defeated states of the First World War. So during this period, we then, as a result of organizations of the extreme right, but also the extreme left and their clashes, we see an extraordinary proliferation of violence, particularly in the vast territories of the now defeated and collapsed, disintegrating land empires of Europe, the Habsburg, Romanov, and Ottoman empires, who, of course, overnight disappeared from the European map in what is arguably the most radical reshuffling of the European territory, of the European continent, in modern history. It is really in this period that you see new national movements trying to define what the successor states might look like, and the emergence of often nervously aggressive successor states to these fallen empires, seeking to defend or expand the real or imagined borders with unrestrained force. So instead of using Smyrna as an example to open the lecture today, I could have chosen many other European cities in which this similar kind of violence is replicated, from Kiev in Ukraine to Riga, from Tampere in Finland, which is, of course, experiencing one of the bloodiest civil wars of the 20th century in exactly this period, during which 1% of the entire population is killed within less than 3 months, which is an often forgotten civil war, and we can talk about this case and its specificity in the discussion later on, if you like. So I could have used various other examples in order to illustrate the argument that the post-war period, in inverted commas, is actually characterized by an absence of peace. It was here in the largely stateless and violently contested spaces of the defeated land empires of Europe that the main political agendas and forms of violence that dominated Europe's mid-20th century crisis, from ethnic cleansing to social and national revolutions and the emergence of totalitarian regimes of different guises, were shaped. So in that sense, the First World War becomes the unintentional, as I said at the beginning, the unintentional enabler of something even more terrible. It creates the spaces in which revolutions can occur, despite the fact that most of the land empires that suddenly disappear in 1918 were actually, in retrospect, remarkably stable, certainly from the vantage point of 1918. I would even go one step further and argue that it is unlikely that any of the extreme ideologies of the 20th century would have come even close to the halls of power without events that occurred in this fateful period between 1916-17 and the Lausanne Treaty of 1923, the period in which a particularly deadly war between states, the First World War, gave way to conflicts whose logic and purpose was in many ways more dangerous. Unlike in World War I, a conflict fought with the purpose of forcing the enemy to accept certain conditions of peace, however harsh, the logic of the post-war violence was much more closely related to the kind of violence that we see in the eastern theaters of the Second World War. These emerging conflicts were existential conflicts fought to annihilate the enemies, be they ethnic enemies, class enemies, or religious enemies, a genocidal logic that would become dominant in Central and Eastern Europe between 1939 and 1945. To illustrate that argument, one could point, for example, to the remarkable and, in my view, often overlooked fact that in November 1918, the First World War on the Western Front comes to a halt. You can stop the violence with an order. Now, try stopping the violence in Russia during the Civil War in 1921. Who's going to stop it? Who's in charge? Who's controlling the violence? It's the decentralized nature of the violence that makes it so infinitely more dangerous. And we have to bear in mind that the Civil War, the Russian Civil War, actually kills more people than Russia loses in the First World War. So for them, this is a conflict whose memory actually largely overshadows the First World War in significance in the literature, but also in public debates. Not since the 30 Years' War of the 17th century had a series of interconnected civil wars been as inchoate and deadly as in the years after 1918. And one of the reasons for that is that civil wars overlapped with revolutions, counter-revolutions, and border conflicts between states or emerging states that weren't even in existence yet, where you have different parties claiming to be the legitimate successor to the national armies that had just disappeared. The death toll of the years between the Great War official end in November 1918 and the Treaty of Lausanne in 1923 was indeed extraordinary, staggering. Even if we exclude from the body count the more than 50 million people who perished in this period from the Spanish flu between 1918 and 1920, or those hundreds of thousands of civilians between Beirut and Berlin who died of starvation as a consequence of the Allied decision to keep up the economic blockade beyond the end of hostilities, essentially to force Berlin and Constantinople to accept the conditions of peace in the peace conference of 1919. So these deaths aside, and not counting the millions of refugees that fled the war-torn lands of Eastern, Central, and Southern Europe, well over 4 million people, more than the combined wartime dead of Britain, France, and the United States, lost their lives as a result of civil wars and inter-ethnic struggles. So given these figures, it is rather astonishing that certainly for decades in the Western historiography, the period after 1918 was characterized as a peace period or an interwar period, which only makes sense from a very limited perspective. So how can we explain this extraordinary eruption of violence? Following the second and even more devastating World War after 1945, many scholars began to suggest that it was the Great War which had unleashed furies that could not be contained sufficiently by the peace treaties of Paris. As many people in this room will be aware, this argument was refined in the so-called brutalization thesis, famously developed in George Mosser's 1919 classic, Fallen Soldiers. Mosser, like many others, was keen to explain how the rise of the Nazis in Germany was possible and essentially suggested that the trench experience of the First World War had generated a brutalization both of the combatants, the soldiers, and society at large by establishing new and unprecedented levels of acceptable violence, which culturally and socially and politically prepared the way for the horrors of the Second World War, during which the number of civilians who were killed in the process exceeded that of the combatants. Relatively recent empirical scholarship has, however, cast doubt on the explanatory value of Mosser's brutalization thesis, as well as its extension to Europe as a whole by scholars like Enzo Traverso and others. The key argument against the brutalization thesis is that the trench experience itself does not explain why the world of politics was brutalized in some combatant states of Europe, but not in others. After all, there was no fundamental difference in the war experience of British or French soldiers on the one hand, and those of the defeated Central Powers on the other. The only major difference is the outcome of the war, whether you were victorious or whether you were defeated. So, in a sort of twist of the brutalization thesis, one could say that the brutalizing moment, I would argue, lay not so much in the war itself, because the overwhelming majority of soldiers did what you would expect people to do. They went home, they had enough of the war. Many of them actually became pacifists because they had first-hand experience of the war. But that the key to understanding the brutalization of European politics and the rise of totalitarian regimes actually lies in the transitional period from war to peace. The case of the already mentioned short but extremely violent civil war in Finland might suffice here to illustrate my point that brutalization in the trenches of the Great War was scarcely needed when it came to unleashing new outbursts of violence. Finland, which had been an autonomous duchy within the Romanov Empire, had not been a combatant in the First World War, and only a handful of volunteers had fought on both sides for Germany and for Russia. So in many ways, the brutalization through the war did not occur in the case of Finland, and it does not quite explain why, as I said, within less than 3 months, more than 30,000 people were killed, often in extraordinary outbursts of violence. The vast majority of these people are not killed in combat. Only 7,000 are actually killed in violent confrontations. The majority is killed after they had surrendered. So they are killed systematically in camps, in improvised camps, after they are after the Reds are defeated in the Spanish Civil War. So in contrast to Mosser, I would like to make a number of different arguments about the brutalization of Europe in this period. First, as I've indicated before, I would suggest that it was not the events on the Western Front between 1914 and 1918 that set the political agendas for decades to come, but the issues that were raised by the war but not solved by it. Nor were these political agendas that were to dominate in Europe for the next decades, set by the main victors of the war, Britain, France, and the United States, on whose peacemaking efforts in Paris much of the existing literature about the transition from war to peace has focused. In order to understand the violent trajectories that Europe, including Russia and the former Ottoman lands in the Balkans and in the Middle East, followed throughout the 20th century, we must look to the way in which the war ended for the defeated, for the vanquished, namely in defeat, imperial collapse, and revolutionary turmoil. The mind-boggling complexity of these post-war conflicts, civil wars and ethnic conflicts, makes it very difficult to find straightforward explanations for the geography and different levels of violence in this period. At the inevitable risk of simplification, however, it is possible, in my view, to suggest that these three overarching themes, which were dominant in the years 17 to 23, help to explain the logic and direction of violence in subsequent decades. First, the Russian Revolution, both as a game-changer in international politics. For the first time since the French Revolution of 1789, there is a revolutionary state in Europe, and just like in 1789, it changes profoundly the balance in the international system. But it's equally important as a fantasy that mobilizes both revolutionaries in other countries of Europe in order to advance revolution, but also, and this is equally important, it mobilizes the forces of counter-revolution, even in countries where a communist revolution is not even on the cards. So this, I think, is one of the very important factors to bear in mind. Secondly, parts of the violence can be explained through the mobilizing power of defeat. So we see far more violence in those states that were defeated in the First World War than in the victor states. Or in the case of Italy, countries that perceived to have been to have suffered a mutilated victory, the famous notion in Italy that the Paris peace treaties did not deliver on the secret promises of the Treaty of London, which convinced Italy to enter the war against her former allies, Austria-Hungary and Germany in the first place, and that the dissatisfaction with the peace settlement essentially pushed people over the edge and into support of Mussolini's fascist movement, which of course became the first fascist movement to rule a state after 1922. The third major aspect to help us explain the different geography is, as I mentioned before, the abrupt breakup of Europe's land empires that led to both traditional land grabbing and new multi-ethnic mini-empires on the one hand, and a consensus among the defeated that the peace treaties had to be revised at any cost, and that the lost minorities who were now living under foreign rule had to be redeemed in one way or another. Let me look at each of these three themes in a little more detail. Wolfgang Schieberbusch famously coined the expression culture of defeat, which I think can be illustrated what that means in the specific case of the defeated powers of 1918, which can be illustrated through the stylized memories of the moment when the most famous participant of the war, the 29-year-old private Adolf Hitler, awoke on the 12th of November 1918 in his military hospital bed in the Prussian town of Pasewalk. He very quickly realized that the world, since he had been unconscious, that the world around him had changed beyond recognition. The once mighty Imperial German Army, in which he had served as a dispatch runner, had collapsed. The Kaiser had abdicated in the face of revolutionary turmoil. Hitler's homeland, Austria-Hungary, no longer existed. Upon receiving news in this hospital bed of the Central Powers' defeat in the Great War, Hitler experienced a complete meltdown, or so he later recalled, in his prison cell in Landsberg, where he was imprisoned for an attempted putsch modeled on Mussolini's march on Rome in 1923. And I quote a very famous quotation from Mein Kampf. I threw myself on my bed and buried my burning head in my pillow and the duvet. I had not cried since the day I had stood at my mother's grave. Now I couldn't do anything else. The perceived humiliation of 1918 remained a central theme of Hitler's career, his speeches, and his life until its violent end in the bunker in Berlin in April 1945. Even in his very final orders, he returns to that moment of 1918, and he insists that there would be no repeat of 1918, no new version of the stab of the back, which is, of course, a very prominent theme in right-wing propaganda in the entire interwar period, the idea that Germany was not defeated on the battlefield, but as a result of internal treason. So he insists that there would be no capitulation. Germany would not capitulate. It would either emerge victoriously from the Second World War, or it would disappear from the map. And he didn't care if the German people would die completely, if they would all disappear from the face of the earth, because in his own ideology, their enemies had proven stronger. Destruction with honor intact, even if it meant the annihilation of the entire German people, was preferable to Hitler than a disgraceful negotiated surrender. November 1918 thus undoubtedly played a crucial role as a reference point in Hitler's life. It was here, in the moment of defeat, or so he later claimed on various occasions, that he decided to go into politics. Roughly at the same time, some 4,000 kilometers to the southeast in Istanbul, the 37-year-old brigadier Mustafa Kemal returned from the Palestinian front, where he had commanded the Ottoman Empire's last offensive against the Entente. In 1926, when he was already president of the Turkish Republic, he recalled his arrival in the defeated Ottoman Empire's capital as a life-changing experience, the beginning of his mission to transform the remnant of the once cosmopolitan empire into an ethnically homogeneous and ethnically cleansed Turkish nation-state. In Istanbul in late 1918, he had found himself surrounded by non-Muslims, notably Christians, Greeks, and Orthodox, and Armenians, for whom the dark days of the armistice were the happiest days of their lives. As he bitterly observed, they welcomed British and French occupiers as liberators. Over the following 3 years, during the border wars against Armenians and Kurds, but most importantly, after his victory over the Greek invasion forces in Asia Minor, Mustafa Kemal would have his revenge, culminating in the massacres of Smyrna and the expulsion of hundreds of thousands of Orthodox Ottoman subjects from Western Anatolia. It was this achievement that allowed Turks to view themselves as victors of the war, even if they had lost the war in 1918. The Treaty of Lausanne, which eventually brings peace to the region, basically turns the results around and confirms that Turkey is actually a victor of the First World War, while Greece becomes a defeated state. This interpretation is, of course, not confined to Turkey. In all of the successor states in Eastern, Central, and Southeastern Europe, as well as in the Middle East and in Ireland, the memory of the Great War is often overshadowed, if not fully eclipsed, by foundational stories of independence struggles, national liberation, but also civil wars that erupt in and around 1918. Hitler and Kemal were not the only future political decision makers whose life trajectories were fatefully transformed by the tumultuous events surrounding the end of the Great War and its immediate aftermath. On the 31st of October 1918, the commander of the Adriatic based Habsburg fleet, Miklos Horthy, sent a final telegram to his Emperor Charles I, assuring him of his unshakable loyalty. Only minutes later, however, he surrendered the flagship of his fleet, somewhat ironically called the SMS Viribus Unitas, with united force, releasing the Czech, Croatian, Polish, and Austrian sailors and officers around him into an uncertain future as post-imperial subjects. For Horthy himself, however, the war was by no means over. Once fighting between the major combatants of the Western Front had ended, he soon found another project, the cleansing of his native Hungary from those forces that had allegedly caused not only the Habsburgs' defeat and the breakup of their empire, but had also staged a communist revolution. As he rode into Budapest, remarkably on a white horse, ahead of his volunteer army in November 1919, his men descended on those suspected of supporting the short-lived communist dictatorship of Béla Kun that had been toppled only days previously by Romanian military intervention. More than 4,000 of the supporters of Kun, left-leaning and particularly Jewish intellectuals and politicians, were to be murdered in the witch hunt that followed over the coming weeks. In the Treaty of Trianon, Hungary lost a staggering two-thirds of its pre-war territory to the neighboring states. This is quite astonishing and roughly equivalent to a peace treaty that would force a British government today to cede Northern Ireland, Scotland, Wales, and the industrial north of England to Ireland and Iceland. It is therefore not a surprise that for a whole generation of Hungarians, the revision of Trianon became the central leitmotif or objective. Resentment for the outcome of the war was not confined to the militarily defeated. It was, as I indicated before, also keenly felt by those who had won the war but believed that they had lost the peace. Notably, in Italy, there was a very strong sense of betrayal, that they had not been rewarded sufficiently for their war debts, which actually outnumber those of Britain. And it was in this general climate that the former socialist journalist Benito Mussolini recognized the growing resentment of many Italians against this mutilated victory. It was in March 1919 that he sketched the political program for a national organization soon to be known worldwide as the Fascist Party. Mussolini was not solely responsible for the fact that, alone of the victorious Entente powers, the Italian state failed within just a few years of the war. Like Hitler, he was able to exploit some key weaknesses of the state and rifts within Italian society. He therefore became the first and prime beneficiary, rather than the cause of the collapse of the liberal system that had governed Italy previously. Nonetheless, one could say that the Italian post-war experience with revolutionary activism of both left and right, paramilitary violence, civil war-like circumstances, and extreme nationalism actually resembled that of the defeated empires of Eastern and Central Europe much more closely than that of Britain or France. What all of the men I just mentioned, Hitler, Ataturk, Horthy, and Mussolini, and many less prominent figures below them, had in common was that their ideologies, their mental maps, and the future direction of their politics were profoundly reshaped by the way in which the Great War ended, and in which the end of the Great War transformed the world around them. The escalation of violence post-1918 owed as much to cultures of defeat and resentment of the defeated states as it did to the second major theme I earlier identified, the lingering threat of world revolution that seemed to emanate from Russia. The Bolshevik Revolution of 1917 and the extremely brutal civil war that followed across Russia's former imperial lands, and particularly in the western borderlands, very quickly interacted with revolutionary and counter-revolutionary movements further afield. For those on the political left, the Bolshevik takeover of power functioned as a beacon of hope for all those who were longing for radical socio-economic and political change, violent change if necessary, while simultaneously becoming the sort of almost realization of a nightmarish vision of the rise of the masses that had preoccupied the European establishment, the middle classes and the upper classes, ever since the French Revolution and then again during the 19th century and the revolutions of 1848. Even in countries where Bolshevik takeover was unlikely, as in Germany or Austria, the successful seizure of power by a determined revolutionary minority of Russian Bolsheviks quickly injected a powerful new energy into politics. In many countries, it triggered the emergence of determined counter-revolutionary forces, heavily armed counter-revolutionary forces, over half a million men in Germany and Austria alone, for whom the suppression of the invisible but apparently omnipresent and ubiquitous threat constituted the overriding goal that bridged the often very significant differences between counter-revolutionaries. So within the counter-revolutionary camp, you've got conservative nationalists, you've got proto-fascists or real fascists, you've got royalists, monarchists. So a very vast array of political movements that are united in one thing only, namely in their determination to quell the threat of Bolshevism with extreme violence. So in many ways, this is comparable to the situation in the late 18th century when Europe's horrified elites feared a Jacobin apocalyptic war, and a similar situation then arises after 1917, where people frequently in newspapers but also in political speeches refer to Bolshevism as a virus, probably mindful of the Spanish influenza that is going on at the same time, a virus that cannot be stopped by national borders, and Mussolini very often also uses medical metaphors. Communism is a gangrene that has to be burnt out in order for the flesh, the national body, to recover. But these very violent metaphors, of course, give you an indication of the common understanding that the only way to defeat this ubiquitous threat that will not stop at national borders is to crack down on it very, very hard and to kill the carriers of the virus in the process. Admittedly, such perceptions were not confined to the defeated. You have similar statements in Britain, in France, and in other places where the wartime enemy, the Hun, the evil German, is very quickly replaced with Bolshevism as the prime enemy of the future. Back in the years 1917 to 23, revolutions and counter-revolutions often overlapped with the third major theme of the period that helps to explain the intensity and geography of post-war violence, namely the effects of imperial disintegration in Europe. In Paris in 1919, the world's political leaders met to draw new lines on the maps of Europe, to invent new countries that had previously not existed, and to confine others to the history books. National self-determination was, of course, the watchword of the day, and it was articulated with very different meanings by both Lenin and U.S. President Woodrow Wilson. While we know a great deal about the fraught negotiations between the Big Four, the principal victors of the First World War in Paris, our knowledge about the effects of the peace treaties on the defeated states of Europe is at best patchy and rarely looked at comparatively. What we do know a great deal about is the Treaty of Versailles with Germany, largely because of the subsequent rise of the Nazis, who very often refer to the peace treaty of Versailles as the real constitution of the Weimar Republic, externally imposed. But I think that the focus on the Versailles Treaty has largely blinded us to the, in fact, much harsher treaties that were simultaneously imposed on Hungary, Austria, and Bulgaria, as well as the Ottoman Empire. It could also be argued that the importance of certain clauses of the provisions, the famous war guilt question and the issue of reparations in the Versailles Treaty, have been overplayed at the expense of the key problem in Paris, namely the problem of recreating an entire continent that had previously been dominated by land empires into what was supposed to become a post-imperial world of nation states, an ambition that actually failed because the successor states of East Central Europe were anything but ethnically homogenous nation states. They were, on the contrary, they were kind of mini-empires with inverted and changed inter-ethnic hierarchies. So those ethnicities that had ruled the empire previously fell down the ladder in terms of importance, whereas these mini-empires were now ruled by other ethnic groups. Benito Mussolini famously commented on the disintegration of the great European land empires with a surprisingly nervous reference. Neither the fall of Rome nor the defeat of Napoleon, he insisted in an article for his newspaper, Il Popolo d'Italia, could compare in its impact on history to the current reshuffling of Europe's political map. The whole earth trembles, he wrote, shaken by a cyclone. In old Europe, empires disappear, systems break, institutions collapse. For once, Mussolini had a point. While the slogan of self-determination provided a very powerful rallying cry for the mobilization of anti-imperial emotions and personnel, it certainly raised more issues than it solved. There was not only the issue of perceived hypocrisy, as Wilson's idea of self-determination was applied to people considered to be allies of the Entente, Poles, Czechs, and Romanians, but not to those viewed as enemies, Austrians, Germans, Hungarians, and Bulgarians. The application of Wilson's principle of national self-determination to territories of serious ethnic complexity, even when bearing in mind the ineffective minority treaties, was at best naive and at worst an invitation to transform the violence of World War I into a multitude of civil wars. The widely perceived problem of multi-ethnicity and religious diversity in post-imperial societies that wanted to be the exact opposite, namely monoreligious and ethnically homogenous, would ultimately, during and after the Second World War, lead to solutions that proved disastrous across the territories of the former land empires. Attempts to cleanse the alien elements so that a utopian new society could emerge to root out those who were perceived to be harmful to the balance of the community. Between 1917 and the later 1940s, violent actors followed a logic born in the immediate aftermath of the Great War. The aim, as I said at the beginning of my lecture, and with that I should probably conclude, the aim was no longer to militarily defeat an opposing army or impose dramatic, if you like, or harsh conditions on the defeated, as had been the case during the Great War. But the aim is now to actually physically annihilate those that stood in the way of the creation of a new utopian society. While European states had sought, certainly since the disastrous religious wars of the 16th and 17th century, to tame war by distinguishing between combatants and non-combatants, and by decriminalizing the enemy as a useless hostis, this trend was now reversed. So, in that sense, I would argue that this period is quite crucial for understanding the new logics of violence that emerged in the aftermath of the First World War, and that it is crucial for understanding subsequent cycles of violence that characterized Europe's mid-20th century crisis. Thank you.
Bé, tenim uns 10 minuts per preguntes, reflexions que vulgueu compartir amb el professor Gerber. Si hi ha algú, alguna, vol obrir el foc, continuant amb la metàfora bèl·lica. Si no vol ningú, comença jo. Ok? Let me start. So. Just a brief question. Maybe not so brief, but your response will not be so brief, probably. And I was wondering about what happens with the argument that, as you probably know, William Mulligan states in his last book about the fact that the First World War is a war for peace. What happens with this idea that, in fact, I think that it probably works during, at least during the first half of the war. I think that it probably works. What happens with this idea, with the fact that the war starts and continues for peace? Probably it works better in some Western countries, but I'm not sure. I really don't know what happens with, for example, the Ottoman Empire or Eastern Europe. If you could.
Yeah, thank you for the great question. Obviously, most European statesmen in 1914 and in subsequent years, hope that there won't be a repeat of the horrors of the First World War. This is supposed to be the war to end all wars. This is supposed to be a conflict that will lead to the solution of many issues at the very heart of European politics, the question of hegemony on the continent. There are unintended consequences. I mean, most people who go to war, most countries that go to war in 1914, assume that this is going to be a brief war, that it will be over in a couple of months. And of course, they are proven horribly wrong. War, the conflict is changing in nature. And by that, I mean, when countries go to war in 1914, they have a relatively, if they have articulated any war aims, it is essentially, you know, to either end German hegemony on the continent, rein that in. On the other hand, Germany feels that the time is ripe to end an encroachment and, you know, preempt a future encirclement. In a war that they might lose, so they want to fight the war as long as the odds are in their favor. But over time, the war aims begin to be more clearly articulated, and I think it is worth bearing in mind that the dismantlement of the land empires is not really on the agenda of the key statesmen until 1918. Of course, there are minorities, Czech minorities, Polish minorities that argue for independent statehood very early on, but these are by no means endorsed by the Allied politicians. So certainly in that respect, the war is changing. On the other hand, you also have, after 4 years of an extremely violent war, by 1916, there are cracks showing. There are strikes at the front and at home. So the longer the war lasts, the more likely a revolutionary change becomes. Without the war, I think it's fairly safe to say the Bolshevik revolution in Russia would have been extremely unlikely. Because unlike in 1905, when we have the first major revolution in Russia, the regime manages to regain control by 1914 and seems fairly firmly in control of its vast territories by the outbreak of the First World War, although it is an extremely autocratic regime. So again, it's the war that opens up the spaces in which revolutionary movements, both of the political left and national revolutionaries, have their opportunity, an opportunity which was impossible to foresee. So a war that may have been fought initially by some as a war to end all wars, a war for peace, gradually gives way to a conflict that follows a very different logic.
Una buena pregunta, ¿ves? Sí, espera que no sé si hay un micro. ¿Tiene un micro allá? No. ¿Sí? Ah, bueno, sí, si vols passar. Ja ho solucionarem de cara a la segona. Sí.
Volia preguntar-li al professor com es passa de d'aquesta Primera Guerra Mundial al concepte de guerra total que d'alguna manera s'implanta durant la Guerra Civil Espanyola i la Segona Guerra Mundial, no? Quins fets fan que després hi hagi aquesta reflexió?
Yeah, thank you. It's a very good question. Of course, many scholars of the First World War would suggest that the First World War was already a total war in the sense that it mobilized entire populations. Now, I think my argument is that the First World War is less of a total war, obviously, than the Second World War. And in order to explain that gradual transformation, I'm looking at these conflicts that follow the First World War chronologically, where we see a totalization. And that totalization could be defined by the deliberate targeting of civilians. Of course, civilians die in large numbers during the First World War as well. But mainly, it's terrible. Mainly as collateral. Not so much because, with the exception of that, genocide is a special case, and I'm happy to talk about that as well. What we see then after the First World War is, if you like, a change that the civilians became legitimate targets. In fact, it is desirable to kill civilians. And in these conflicts, you often find that the civilians killed outnumber those of regular combatants killed, just like in the Second World War. And I would see the Spanish Civil War in that continuation as a sort of, as part of that new form of civil wars which are enabled by the weakening of the state effectively as a consequence of the First World War. Of course, Spain, although neutral in the First World War, and there is a growing literature on this, could still be considered a mobilized country. You don't have to be a combatant country to be mobilized by war, because the economy is adjusted, because people are obviously also inspired by events in Russia in 1917. So even though it is not a combatant, you can perhaps quite usefully compare the case to Finland, the Finnish Civil War, where also a totalization of conflict is independent from participation of the Great War.
Perdoneu, la última pregunta y
possible to identify any period of peace since First World War? Can you find any period of peace? We could say this is a peace period in Europe since then.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there are several peace periods. I mean, one I would say that there is a post-war period after the First World War, but that begins in 1923. Relatively brief. Probably from 1929 onwards, we see a re-radicalization of politics, but certainly between 1923 and 1929, before the outbreak of the Great Depression, there is a period of relative peace compared to what happening before and after. And then, of course, the new cycle of violence, if you like, starts with the Spanish Civil War and then goes through all the way to the Second World War and the subsequent Greek Civil War. And then there is the enforced pacification by the Cold War. So from the later 1940s onwards until the collapse of the Iron Curtain, Europe, not the world as such, but Europe is actually experiencing a remarkably long period of peace.
Bé, ho deixem aquí. Thank you very much for the lecture, for your responses. And continuem. Ara farem una a diferència del que havíem posat amb el programa, hem pensat que era millor fer una pausa ara per fer un cafè durant uns 25 minuts. Tornem aquí d'aquí a les 11:30, 12:15, amb la següent conferència. Gràcies.